Well, hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And we're going to do a part two with Howie Gordon, aka Richard Pacheco. His wonderful, fascinating, illuminating book, Hindsight, True Love and Mischief in the Golden Age of Porn. And the book's foreword is by his friend Whoopi Goldberg. Last week, we talked about the psychology of porn, the deeper meanings of his work, and some of his favorite actresses. And just as an aside, I want to say before we bring Howie into this conversation and focus on him, that in the 30 years that I've been practicing, I have never seen a negative effect from introducing people to erotica, particularly films that are female-friendly. It seems to give people permission to release guilt about sexual fantasy. People do still have guilt about that. And I think if the person is going to be compulsive or addictive, they're going to find, another thing to do that with. So welcome back, Howie Gordon. I'm so glad you've agreed to do this show today.
My pleasure. Tuesdays with Dr. Diana.
Oh, maybe we can even do a part three at some point. I hope so. Your book is, let's see, how many pages is it? It's a big book with so much in it and so many photographs. And I do hope that people that listened to part one last week, either live or by going to the archives, will go ahead and get a copy. It's officially, it's just 364 pages, right? So it's a big book. And
but
it was
400 pictures.
And 400 pictures.
Yeah.
So you were good about saving your mementos, the photos and the and other things through the years.
In 1965, back before you were born.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I went to Northwestern University, Medill School of Journalism. And one of the first things that happened was a professor stood up in front of the class and said, wrote on the blackboard, actually, a writer writes. And he turned around, try to live an interesting enough life that people will want to read about it.
Oh, and boy, started, that inspired you, didn't it?
Well, I started keeping a diary right then and there, August of 1965, and now I'm up to volume number 152.
Really?
So that's been the baseline. I found that over the years it's gone through many stages, but essentially my diary has been my best friend. And it's a place for me to go, and when I get too confused about things, sort things out, write things down. That's worked for me, so that's what I do. I'm a writer. The acting thing came just because I happened to be good at it. It wasn't something I pursued. I was pretty good as a cold read. I never got much better after the first read, but the cold read was always pretty good. That's carried me a long way, especially in the X-rated world where the as they say, the one-eyed man is king in the land of the blind.
That's, I'm sure my listeners got that, or our listeners got that. That's very clever. Well, one of the things, of course, that makes you so charming, both on screen and off, is your sense of humor. And I read in your book, we didn't discuss this off the air, but I know you'll remember it, that you were on Joan Rivers back in, was right after you retired, I think.
1985, when the first, after the first heterosexual transmission of AIDS hit the headlines.
Right.
Which was at the end of 84.
So,
I stopped working in the X-rated world, and she wanted me to come on and talk about that because it was a headline, and it was people were scared. It was a long time before we had any good information about how AIDS was being transmitted.
Right. And so you talked about it, but you talked about it in a funny way, so funny that Joan Rivers suggested you be a stand-up comic.
Well, the AIDS discussions weren't funny, but in the course of being on the show, she was asking me about how do you function sexually, and I in the movies, and I said very poorly, which is true. I had a very difficult time learning how to have sex on camera. And in the face of such terror and humiliation that I went through, I became very funny. I amused her and with some of the stories of my travail. In fact, there's a lot of that in the book where you can find out you know, when 50 people are watching you and you've got dead spaghetti between your legs, you better be funny. You better be something.
It's a great coping mechanism, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it helped me. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, crying is a little too much. but in any case, when we were on a break at the show, she said, you know, you're pretty funny. You ought to be doing stand-up. And at this point, I needed a second career. So I said, great. That's one of the reasons I came to New York. What do I do? And she pointed to a fellow offstage and said, go see him after we're done. He'll get you started. Mm-hmm. And I go offstage and see the gentleman afterward, and he was a producer. He owned this and that. And the essence of which, he says, yeah, I'll put you to work. I own a string of comedy clubs in Canada. And you'll start on the East Coast, and you'll work your way west. In about 3 months, you'll land in L.A., and you'll go from there. And, oh, here I am. I'm discovered again. So I go running over to my wife, and I say, dear, this guy wants to put me to work, and blah, 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 blah. And she looks at me with her head kind of funny. We had a brand-new baby and a two-year-old. And she said to me, oh, is this the part where you run off to be a movie star and leave me home alone with two children? I don't think so, asshole.
And the asshole part got your attention.
It got my attention. She
yeah.
Asshole. I mean,
right.
You know, I knew me too well. I didn't want to run off alone. I wanted the life that the two of us had created. I wanted the children that we had created.
Yeah.
And I knew if I ran off, I'd be chasing women and just making a mess of things. So.
Yeah. So you knew yourself.
Yeah. I wasn't a spring chicken. I'd been around the block a few times.
Yeah.
And, at that point, we had to find an occupation that I could stay at home and do. And I turned my writing, which had been not a vocation, but an avocation, tried to turn it into a career at that point.
Yeah.
And I had a get-rich-quick scheme to write about the adult film industry, and here it is 30 years later.
30 years later.
I'm about to cash in.
Right. So we're going to talk more about your book. It really is a wonderful book and funny and informative. I liked it so much. And I haven't read it cover to cover, but I've read lots of it. So it's one of those books you can kind of skip around in and still benefit. I'm wondering, before you retired from porn and your films were going strong and you had a lot of them, do you feel like you were able to educate men to please women? And
well,
did your films demonstrate any techniques or how to take time, that sort of thing?
On occasion, but it was never the intention. People, like Nina Hartley, has done a long series of educational sexual videos about how to, you pick in the various aspects of sexuality,
right.
Or fetish, in any case, whatever it is. And she demonstrates how to do those things. When you're an actor in films, you're not yourself. You're playing a character.
That's right.
And you actually, if it's done at all well, and that's not always a guarantee in that universe, the quality of your sex reflects the character you're playing. Not your own personal preferences. So I wasn't hired to be me. Me was in the dressing room with my clothes. I was hired to be whatever they told me to be, and that's what an actor is. An actor is paint, and the director is the painter. Occasionally, you'd hit a scene where you could display some sensitivity or your own preferences, but more often than not, and that's just only in the making of the film, because once the raw footage is there, they take that and edit it into whatever they want. So you can put all kind of stuff into the scene you think you've done well, but it doesn't even make it out of the cutting room into the movie. So
right.
You never know what you're going to get.
Yes.
I remember I did one movie where I was supposed to play a backward fellow and close to retardation. And at one point in the sex, moistened my finger and was rubbing her nipple. And the director said, what are you doing? That character would never do that. That's way too sophisticated. Stop it. Remember who you... Because once the sex starts, it's pretty easy to forget who you are sometimes in the movie business.
I would imagine.
With any luck. But you can't, you know. You've got to stay in character. And, you know, you do your best. At least this was working for Anthony Spinelli, who was the premier director in the business. He cared more about the acting than anybody else. And that's
Spinelli. And he was your mentor, wasn't he?
He was the backbone of my career.
I was
a mentor and a friend, and he helped me navigate, on occasion, a sea of sharks. And what I mean by that is, as I got to be a, sort of a name in the business, I had a call one day from a fellow in New York telling me he wanted to use me in his movie. So I called my friend, Anthony Spinelli, and said, blah, blah, wants to hire me to work in his movie. And he said, oh, no, 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 you don't want to work for him.
Uh-huh.
And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he says, he's not making movies. He's breaking legs.
Oh, dear.
Exactly.
Dangerous guy.
Yeah, well, that's the business had its share of danger. And he helped me navigate those waters because an actor is the last person to know anything about what's going on.
All right.
It's not like they say, hi, we're with the Tattaglia family, and we'd like you to make some dirty movies for us, and we have great dental benefits. We won't knock your teeth out. No, that never happened, you see. An actor was not exposed to where the money came from or who was making the big profits. You were just a schlub on a salary at an entry-level occupation in the entertainment media. If you were lucky. But, you know, the sad part about adult films is everybody in the industry graduated to straight stuff, except for the actors and actresses.
Really? Say a little more about that, Howie.
The people who did cinematography, the people who did sound, the people who did costumes, the people who did makeup, they got unbelievably fantastic training in adult films because you're making movies at fractions of the cost of what they spend in television and straight films.
Yeah.
And you work at speed of light. just under the gun. When you can accomplish that much with that little, you've got some skills.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take that into the straight world, it's like a day off, and you're being paid five times what you get paid in the X-rated world, in those jobs. For the actors and the actresses, when you walk in to see an agent or a casting director and you tell them you've been in X-rated movies for the last 10 years and you'd like to try out for blah, blah, they tell you, what's that smell in the room? Do you have shit on your shoes? And there's the door. Don't let it hit you in the ass on the way out.
Oh, they're that harsh.
Yeah, it's just brutal. It's, you know, you can't breathe a word of it. And if you become known, then they'll know it sooner or later anyway. So the door's not open. Because the truth is, at that level, there's 10 guys that look just like you, who are just as good as you. And why would they take anybody as talent where they could have controversy? You just don't want it. Controversy doesn't make money in that milieu.
It sounds as though you have sorted this all out in a really healthy way, so you understand, and you're not going to take it so personally.
Well, you do, and then you grow up.
Yes, it helps to grow up.
You can tilt against the windmills all you want, but at some point, you accept the world as it is. I'm 65 years old. I try to learn from my experiences, and the world does change. One of the first people that crossed over into straight films from adult stuff in recent years was Sylvester Stallone. But he had already made Rocky before anybody knew anything about that. So he was able to skate.
I did not know that. That's fascinating.
And then there's people like Tracy Lords more recently. But, you know, it's interesting that she quit the X-rated business once it was discovered that she was working underage.
Mm-hmm.
And went straight, and I don't know the details on that. She'll have to tell you about that. But
mm-hmm.
She went straight, but if you look at the straight she went, if you look at the film she's in, she's playing an X-rated character, essentially.
Yeah.
She's the harlot and the starlet and blah, blah, blah. So the fact that she has on an article or two of clothing really doesn't change the role she's getting or got at that stage. She's no longer a youngster either.
Well, it's inevitable, right? We all age.
Jeremy, he's sort of like become a comic version of the X-rated actor who's been adopted by mainstream to a degree. He's infamous and comical. And we look at Ron and we're sort of taught by the mainstream media to laugh at him. He's portrayed somewhat buffoonish, which is sad because, he's got a lot to offer. But in any case, the doors are not open.
And you said in our show last week, I believe it was, that Ron Jeremy has worked very hard through all these years.
24/7 to knock down the doors and try to get in. And he's done it, to a degree. He's done it quite a bit, more than anybody else that's ever been in the X-rated industry. I would have to say the most famous person other than him would be John Holmes. And John Holmes was famous because he had a penis larger than a donkey.
And then he died of AIDS.
Well, that he did, which I'm sure didn't help his legend any.
No, and it must have scared you enough that you decided to retire once AIDS was on the horizon.
Well, more than you know, my dear, because when he came back after his adventures with the Wonderland Murders to resume his career, I was on the set with him. I worked in a movie with him. And we were with, you know, some of the same women. And it was discovered after the fact that he was working when he knew he had had AIDS. And he didn't tell anybody. So that was, you know.
Unconscionable, don't you think?
Yeah, despicable is the word, or desperate. And,
desperate.
One can understand it in the larger picture. But when you're waiting for the results of your AIDS test because of actions that someone taken, you might not be so liberal in your assessment.
That using the word desperate, this is a segue.
Go ahead.
So in your book, you say, I rejected all acts of desperation as available options. The years have taught me that desperate fucks aren't worth having. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because this is certainly one of the things that you've learned.
Well, and, I can. This was personal and not professional in the
Right.
My wife was out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
I took this as an opportunity of free play. I didn't think monogamy was going to cross the ocean. so I was trying to line up a date for myself to have some of that, which I can say imaginary or wishful thinking male sexuality of finding a woman out there that is going to give you hot, delicious sex, and there'll be no repercussions on your marriage. We delude ourselves with that's actually a possibility.
Yes.
Despite basic instinct and all the other experiences to the contrary. So I was in that place, and I was invited to an SM party. And I went thinking I would be able to connect with somebody. I went by myself. Well, it turned out to be a nightmare in the sense that there were very few single women there. And the ones that were there were not the least bit interested in me or I them. And I had two nights to do this in between the child care that I had to do and the babysitting I had arranged and all this. And so one night was down. Now it's my second night. What am I going to do?
Uh-huh.
And I remember thinking, well, in the old days, I would go to bars and look for someone to pick up in a bar.
Uh-huh.
And that never worked for me.
Never did.
Mm-hmm. Because even if I connected with somebody, the idea, all the sturm und drang you had to go through, especially in this day and age, to say to make the relationship clear, this is a one night stand. I got a wife, I got kids, and then you got to do the AIDS history. You know, when were you last tested?
It's sort of overwhelming, and you know it's going to be doomed for failure.
It's just so much, and then when you get there, it's a new person. I don't do well with new people. I'm generally the first time around. It takes some time and trust to make me be able to function. And in my book, I go into great detail about how in the business as a male actor, foreplay often consisted of the director saying to the woman, you get on your knees to the guy, you pull down your pants back to the woman, you suck him till he's hard, and then we'll shoot. Okay. You may or may not have had an introduction before that.
Already. She's sucking on you.
Or else it's like to the woman, you bend over and pull your panties down, and you fuck her. She may or may not turn around to say hello. I don't do well.
You have one picture in your book where the actress is head is in the curtain. You can't even see her.
Yes, it's a reenactment of the Gong Show. We called it the Dong Show. And she had her head through the curtains like the audience could see her head. And I was backstage with her bottom, and we were allegedly having sex, but I couldn't get it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was no sex to be had. But I just don't do well in that. Now, some guys like that. They don't care who the woman is. It's just the hole they're borrowing. Okay, I get it, you know.
A hole they're borrowing, my goodness. Okay.
When
so
I was 19,
history,
that might have worked. But
your history is that you called up Candida Royale many years ago when she was an actress.
Yes.
I guess it was Pizza Girls. You also called up Nina Hartley before you had worked with her. And you asked each woman if you could get together and just chat and get to know each other. And maybe even have a sex rehearsal.
Nina Hartley was 10 years later. And she's the one that called me.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. But by the time you get to be a known person in the industry, you've been around long enough that you've met most of the women, or a lot of the women, because there's always new blood coming in. The industry is always on the perpetual search for 18-year-old girls. But I had some. By the time you get some juice as a leading male actor, you can start picking the women you want to work with. So you can arrange for the introduction. You're not quite as nobody desperate as I was in the beginning, just to get a friendly smile and a hello.
Of course, and that's what you needed, some emotional foreplay.
Yeah. Hello. let's just go with a hello. I wasn't shooting for the moon. Hello would have been great. And I like men. I like men would have been nice, too, because there were a number of women in the industry that could care less.
Really? The bisexuals?
They're there for the money. And, you know, the game is, how little can I do and still get paid? I've been in scenes. There was a scene I did in a movie called Tangerine, where I was with three women, and just me. And you think that's a night, you know, in Clover. Well, we're actually shooting, and it's foreplay time, and we're passing her, and the director is calling out shots, what to do. You're not in free play here. He's telling you exactly who's what gets what and when. And one of the women whispers in my ear, "Do not touch me unless you absolutely have to."
Oh, my goodness.
Well, and they're rolling camera. I mean, there's film running. And somebody's whispering this in your ear that you're trying to have sex with. Okay.
And, you know, that can be a deflator in terms of your erection.
Yeah, well, there's two other women there, so, you know, you're...
Okay, so you have some others to possibly play with.
You have to put this into the hopper and figure it in. You're thinking on your feet here, so to speak. At one point, however, the director gives me a direct direction to enter this particular woman. Enter her. With my penis. Okay. She did open the door. I did pass through the gates. I am inside her. And there's a beautiful smile on her face. And I couldn't help whispering in her ear, "Is it okay now that I'm touching you?" And she just smiled and said, shook her head, yes. So that one worked out. But it doesn't always work out.
Right.
Another time I was in a movie called Telefantasy. And I played a John in a massage parlor. And she's supposed to just rub me, blow me, and fuck me. Okay, she's rubbing the action. She's rubbing me for 10 seconds. She starts blowing me for about another 10 seconds. And then she just spits out my penis, and it's followed by about 60 seconds of vituperation. How I can't get it up, and I'm helping you. And you. This is sexual abuse.
Of course it is, and it does nothing for your sexual confidence.
This was not good for my self-esteem.
No.
But the director mercifully just said, okay, you know what, let's just cut the scene, because he saw that she didn't want to be with me, and that was that. So, okay. But these are some of the things you learn the hard way, and that's a recurring theme in my book, Things You Learn the Hard Way.
Things You Learn the Hard Way.
What was your question? Did I learn? Did I do a perform? Did performing sex help me educate? No. By and large, that was not the function.
Now, but I have a great quote from Candida Royale, and she said, on a sailing vacation in 1986, she was with her husband, who was also a porn director at the time, and we put some X-rated videos in. I found other people making love was very arousing and permission-giving, sort of like a rooting team, like, hey, yay, everyone's doing it. Hey, so what? It's good, clean fun. And, of course, it does, I think that's something that erotic porn films do, is give a lot of permission to people. It's okay. It's just sex.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's good and bad permission, because when the sex is demonstrated to be non-consensual sex.
Oh, well, no, of course.
It's all there. That's the point.
Mm-hmm.
The message is still given. This goes on. There's the old consciousness when a woman says no, she really means yes. I mean, that was the 1950s for everybody. So
Men have carried that over, haven't they?
Well, if you're a man, you learn that you're supposed to convince the girl. So no doesn't necessarily mean no. You keep you keep at it, and sooner she'll be overwhelmed by her own desire, which she'd been. I mean, in those days, it seemed like the roles were clearer. Men were responsible for initiating sex acts. Women were responsible for putting on the brakes when it got too far. And that's how we maintained virginity. I mean, that was the growing up in the 50s, which got blown out in the 60s when the pill came along.
That's right.
But so, you know, we're giving good and bad messages in our sexual films, but we're also giving those same good and bad messages in our straight films. The irony here is that porn is being held to a completely different standard. Mm-hmm. Nobody talks about rape on television, which you can probably see every night, as well as murder. But in porn, if either of those things go on, then we've got people marching on City Hall. So it's a double standard there.
It's a real double standard. That's exactly what I was thinking. So when we come back from the break, we still have a couple of minutes before the break, but I want to let the audience know that we're going to talk about the fact that, and you can begin to talk about it, that you, when you retired and you did it for your family since it was the advent of AIDS, you say in your book you really had no closure. And the World Pornography Conference in 1998 provided some closure for you. And I think there's some wonderful stories that our listening audience would love to hear about. And if they get your book, they can get all of the details and the photographs. I mean, you have one photograph. I know Sharon Mitchell. It's quite a revealing picture of her over your shoulder. Golly.
There's nothing left for the imagination there.
That's right. And she's gone on to do some really good work with her clinic.
Yes. For many, many years, she helped track my brain's not connected to my tongue. There were testing going on about, for AIDS prevention purposes.
That's right. So, all right. So we're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we're going to learn more about this World Pornography Conference and how he got some closure. So stay with us, please. Let me put out there that if any of you want to call in to ask this wonderful guest that I have today, question, it is 888-874-4888, and you'll be talking first to Melissa, our producer. So, Howie, World Pornography Conference in 1998, and you stood in front of a huge audience and read a piece you'd written, Richard Pacheco is Dead.
Yeah.
And that's because you had retired after the advent of AIDS. And I do want you to embellish on this, but one of my favorite paragraphs in your book is this, and this was part of your presentation. People were all uptight about sex, but there was no reason to be. We were like noble rogues in some divinely human struggle to make life in a body easier. It was important work. We shook the world. My generation tried to make lust respectable. And I say, hear, hear.
Me too.
Yes.
Me too. That's a nice, I like that, you know.
I like it too, a lot. So you said in that same talk, and after which you got a standing ovation.
Well, let me give you some backstory.
Yeah, that would be great. That's what I was hoping you would do, some backstory.
Simply, I did my last sex scene in around 1987. I originally stopped in 85 for an entire year, until we started talking about safe sex. And then I thought, well, I can come back and have a career.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went and did four more scenes trying to wear a condom. And only on one of those four was I able to sexually function. And after the fourth time, I realized it's really over.
Mm-hmm.
I had a year to practice being out of it, and it was time to really just retire.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the AIDS crisis would be over in 3 months, 6 months. and I would go to resume my career. I did not want my career to end. I had been in the business for 10 years, had come up through the ranks, and was now making $1,000 a day, riding around in limousines, being invited to Hefner's house with the after the award shows. I didn't want to say goodbye to that. It took me a long time to get there.
Of course not. And it was fun.
Yeah. Well, it had its ups and downs.
Yeah, of course.
So to speak. But I felt like Ali when they took his title away, you know, because of his stance on the draft. I wanted to resume my career. And then I did quit, and I was not welcome in the X-rated world because I talked about AIDS. And I talked about AIDS prevention. I talked about how you're risking your life here. Wake up. And they got no traction. People who were making their incomes out of that world did not want to know about it or hear about it. And basically, I was shunned. My friends were my friends, but don't bring it here. Don't talk about it. And I didn't. You know, I accepted that fate. That's how it goes. There were some people like me, and Ed Haven was one. And there were some others, but basically it was business as usual. And so here we are 10 years later, and Annie Sprinkles invites me to come down to do a performance for this World Pornography Conference. And I decided to do it. And it was like 10 years had melted. I was back in my element. They were calling some of my movies classics.
I was
grabbing at the brass ring of Sex Star again, and it felt great because by then, Jesus, how old was I? I was getting to be mid-40s, up close to 50, and it was nice to just taste that fountain of youth again. And
for
4 days, if I didn't look in a mirror, it was still the early 80s, and I was still riding high as Richard Pacheco. So that was wonderful. Another wonderful event, after I gave that performance on the opening night, I went to a party at the hotel where everybody who was in the show was gathering afterwards, and Betty Dodson walked into the room. For those of you viewers out there that don't know her, Betty Dodson is one of the great pioneers of sex therapy that
she's
we have.
Huge.
She lives and works in New York.
Yep.
And she did a lot of work for non-orgasmic women, they called them at the time. Masters and Johnson kind of shifted the title to pre-orgasmic women. And Betty helped them learn how to have orgasms in
she's
a very
still helping
way.
Them through her DVDs. The Orgasm Doctor, I recently loaned that DVD to a 23-year-old client of mine who'd never had an orgasm. She watched the DVD and did everything I suggested she do with her partner, and she had her first two orgasms.
Amen.
Yeah.
So Betty Dodson walks into the party.
Yeah.
And
she's outrageous and just wonderful woman.
Well, she walks right up to me and then plops herself down in my lap.
Yeah.
No, we didn't know each other.
Right.
But I had just done a little naked performance on stage, and this was my big night back. And to tell you the truth, it didn't matter if Barbara Streisand or Whoopi Goldberg or Betty Dodson plopped in my lap. This was backstage in Pornoland, and backstage in Pornoland was a wonderful place. Grab ass abounded. If you belong there, it was a good place to be. So the fact that she landed in my lap, I took as par for the course because, you know, I always thought the rich are different, and I figured you might as well throw the famous in there too. And besides, you know, you had to factor in a certain amount of chutzpah or nerve because she lived in New York City, and that just goes with the territory. So her landing there didn't surprise me. And in no time at all, we became wonderful friends, like we'd known each other forever. Okay, so the party's over. We go our separate ways. In the morning, I'm walking by an elevator, and she comes off the elevator, and she's looking very sheepish. And she walks up to me and she says, "Do you remember when I sat in your lap last night like I'd known you forever?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, I thought I did. I thought you were somebody else."
Was that a little deflating?
No, because she said, "I really, you know, is it okay? Because I really love you. And I think, I want us to be okay with that." And I said, "Lady, you picked the right lap. You're one of the heroes of heroes to me." And, feelings mutual.
Yeah.
And then she said, "Okay, now I wish I could remember who I thought you were."
Well, at that point, I don't think it mattered too much.
this is this conference, and it's just one event after another like this for 4 days. And at the end of the 4 days, there's this massive meeting of everybody in the Sheraton Ballroom.
Yeah.
And there's going to be about 10 or 15 actors and actresses speaking in a meeting that's titled Everything You Wanted to Know About Performing in Porn.
Mm.
And I'm invited to be one of the speakers. So I'm sitting on the dais, and I'm sitting in between Nina Hartley and a young woman named Meridian, who was newish to the business back then. And I have this weird idea. They can't see us from the chest down. There's like a kind of...
A curtain.
On the table that we're sitting behind. So they're only seeing us from the chest up. And I think, wouldn't it be fun to sit here in this Hilton Ballroom or Sheraton Ballroom with my pants off?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like a reverse, when you get scared on stage, you imagine the audience sitting in their underwear.
Yeah, but so, I think it shows your naughty side.
Well, also my playful side, because...
I'm playful, of course.
This was the end, you know. I knew that tomorrow I was going to be back driving the kids to soccer practice and making dinner, and this was over. I wasn't resuming my career in any way, shape, or form. This was a one-night, you know, one-shot deal, 4 days.
Right.
And I was making the most of it.
Sure.
Besides, there's a wonderful story about Mel Brooks, who said, nobody ever snuck into show business. Mm. Don't be afraid of the bold move. Make
a bold
notice.
Move.
Do something. So This was my doing something. I was having fun. And I'm sitting there in my underpants, and instantly Nina's hand comes in from one side and Meridian's from the other, and it's just like backstage on a set, and I'm thinking to myself, there really is a God.
You've got two great hands.
And, you know, now I'm watching the conference. I'm being fondled, and, you know, I'm in a ballroom. This is just great.
Inappropriately enough.
Yeah. So it comes time for me to give my speech, and I stand up. Now, still, the audience cannot see me below
the
waist.
Right.
So I'm wearing my suit coat and my shirt, and I walk to the podium. When I get to the podium, everybody on stage can see I'm not wearing any pants. All my fellow actors and actresses. And they just start howling because it's a surprise. And Bill Margold, who was the host, he motions to me, there's some risers behind the stage we're on, that I should mount the risers and let the audience in on the joke. And no, I don't want to do that. That's not what this is about. This is for us. I'm doing this, and I just play it like, I don't know when to be laughing. I straight face it and act the fool. So, okay, so now I give my speech. And my speech, I sure would love to perform it for you, but it's way too long to do on your show. You'd have to get another hour. But I give a speech of a piece I wrote called Richard Pacheco is Dead. And it's funny, and it's poignant, and it's the best I can do as a writer. I'm proud of it.
Well, and I've already quoted that one paragraph that I just love.
Yeah, me too.
But
I like
you,
it.
But and another sentence I like is, his mind became a war zone between the past and the present.
Yeah, well, that's what was happening.
The
First Church of What's Happening. Remember Flip Wilson?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah, that was the First Church of What's Happening. So that's what was happening. And
so,
really,
but Dan, tell our listening audience what you did with your pants and Betty Dotson.
Oh, well,
I was saying to the audience,
before I launched into that Richard Pacheco piece, I was saying to the audience, aren't you sad this is going to be over? I've had such a good time. I met Betty Dotson. And then it just dawned on me, this was totally off-the-wall gesture. I saw her standing there. She was sitting in the audience. I saw she was sitting in the middle of the room. And I just had this impulse. I took off my underpants. And the audience, again, couldn't see what I was doing, but they could recognize what I was doing when I held them up over my head. And I threw them out into the audience, and I said, will somebody please see that those get to Betty Dotson?
She must have. I love that.
So there's my underpants in the fifth row, sixth row, seventh row, moving their way back to Betty Dotson. And she gets them in her hands, and she stands up, and she puts them to her nose and breathes in deeply.
That sounds like Betty.
She throws both fists into the air triumphantly like she scored a touchdown. And the audience is roaring. And I'm thinking, I wouldn't trade that moment for a bigger dick.
No. I loved it when you wrote that, too. Because one of Betty's greatest qualities, and by the way, you know, but not everyone knows, although she was a guest on this program a couple of years ago, that she's a fine artist. I mean, she's really good.
Oh, God, yes. That's what made her name initially in the world
of media. That's right. That's right. So Betty is totally outrageous, and that makes her a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So before the program ends, I do want to spend a little time talking about your post-porn life, and it is shown rather well in the documentary After Porn Ends. And there's a lovely scene. My partner Brian and I watched it again Saturday night. There's a lovely scene with your daughter talking about how really cool her dad is and how smart. And it's just so sweet that your daughter comes in on this. Because, well, set up After Porn Ends just a little bit, because I maybe jumped ahead too quickly.
Well, there have been a number of movies, documentaries I participated in since I stopped working in X, where I'll get a call asking would I be interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, usually these are people who have got their agenda fixed before they've examined their evidence, because I don't fit their agenda. And then they're stuck with me because I don't fit the mold. They want to tell a story of how porn leads to ruin. We're back into Music Man. Shooting pool in River City will bring the devil around. And they take the people who end up like bugs on the windshield of life, and they want to tell their stories. And the people like me who participated in the industry and come out of it still being able to walk and chew gum, they don't want that story. But they get it because they didn't know that what was happening, and they're not sure what to do with that. And to their credit, in After Porn Ends, they pretty much played that straight. They didn't edit me completely out. They gave me a prominent role in the film or the video, and in the advertising sense, I've seen whole shows where some of the people have been interviewed, and they don't mention my name because the show is all about how evil it all is. So they concentrate on the bad stories, the women who, you know, were not happy about it, who found Jesus or whatever they found. Or
the reformed whore.
Or regret what they have participated in.
Mm-hmm.
So this was one of those deals. And what made me even less stereotypical is that I have a child. Actually, I have three. Mm-hmm. And my eldest happened to be home that day, and she walked into the room and sat down next to me and participated in the interview. And she's my kids have known about Richard Pacheco since they were very little, because when the phone rang, I had to say, when the phone rings and somebody asks for Richard Pacheco, don't hang up. That's a name Daddy uses in the movie business.
Right, right.
Daddy makes movies? Yeah, Daddy makes movies. Can we see them? Can we see them? Oh, no, Daddy makes grown-up movies. Oh. Now, that lasted when they were 3 and 4 and 5. And
right.
Then one day when eldest daughter was about 12 and her sister was 10, they were standing. The eldest was in my bathroom combing her hair, and the younger, the middle daughter, just out of nowhere, turns to me and says, "What makes them grown-up movies, Daddy? You mean like Silence of the Lambs?" No. We wouldn't let them see that. She said, "Well, what makes them grown-up? Sex?" It was just the nail on the head.
Sure.
And I went,
wisdom out of the mouths of babes, right?
Yeah, and I said, well, yeah. So she starts jumping up and down, literally, "Daddy makes sex movies! Daddy makes sex movies!" And her older sister, who's 2 years older, she's not going to let her younger sister get a rise out of her, no matter if there's an earthquake and the end of the world's coming. She continues combing her hair and goes, "So what?" And her little sister, from having her mouth open and jumping, just freezes and goes, "Oh, it's not a big deal." Okay. And I tiptoed out of the room, just skating on that piece of sibling
life. And your youngest is a son, and he has made a movie or a show. What was it? But I love the title.
It was based on Debbie Does Dallas. He did a show called Debbie Does My Dad.
That's a great title.
He talked about how it affected his life, the fact that I had been in the X-rated movie business.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know anything about it other than that I was Richard Pacheco. By the time the kids were moving out of infancy, I was done in the business. So it didn't really happen in the time of their conscious lives, except for interview kind of things. But that was few and far between because, like I said, I was personally not welcome in that world for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was a soccer player, and a number of the guys on his team stumbled into who I was, and he'd kind of been like a low man on the totem pole because he wasn't as fast to mature as some of the other guys. They had the mustaches and were already into girls way before he knew that such things existed. But now they were treating him with a certain, he was cool because I was his dad, and he had no idea where that came from. So he wanted to, you know, what is that? We started talking about some things, and, you know, he was on his way to puberty and right knocking on the door. But the truth of the matter is he is always temperamentally more like his mother than me. So the influences that worked on me at that age, for instance, I had the largest breasts in the seventh grade. I was the fat kid. I was completely sexually repressed and ignorant and had no access to information. And desperately romantic and shamed by my body.
Yes.
Those are the people who become sex stars. Those are the people who become centerfolds.
Mm.
Those are the people who have something to prove. You know,
Something to prove. Mm-hmm.
If you look at the 10th reunion in high school, it's revealing. The guys who were tremendous athletes and on the football team or baseball teams when they were in high school, 10 years after high school, they're generally 50 pounds overweight.
Yes.
Because they've been there and done that. The
mm-hmm.
ones that were 50 pounds overweight or underweight or whatever in high school, 10 years later, they look great because they missed that. They want to get that. So they chase it and try to make it happen for themselves. It's not 100%, of course, but that story gets duplicated every day all over the world.
I absolutely believe that, yes.
So
the other thing about that is that sometimes the real nerds in high school become the Bill Gates of the world.
Yes.
So.
We had one fellow who, Wayne was his name, and Wayne was a woodworker. We grew up in the era of Sputnik, and math and science was just shoved down our throats.
Yes.
We had to excel. We had to beat the Russians in scholastic achievement. I was in a very competitive high school, academically oriented. And we just belittled him because he was the king of woodshop. He was winning state prizes, it shows, for his bowls and this and that. And we made fun of him as if that had no real value. And
uh-huh.
We couldn't have been more ignorant. It was just pathetic because the man was a prodigy in many mm-hmm. ways with that skill. And we were too dumb and biased to recognize the value of such a thing.
Right. So before today's show ends, I'd like for you to discuss that part of your life that was like 44 years of foreplay.
Oh,
Sally.
Right, yeah.
And before you talk about it, I have to quote from your description of this, another favorite paragraph of mine. Life gave us a pass. We were the 14-year-old kids again, only this time we were not afraid of sexual pleasure. We had the benefit of knowledge and appreciation. So give us the backstory.
You're going to make me cry. That was wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that so much because I'm all about older sexuality and having a good time and having the benefit of knowledge and appreciation and maturity.
We should go on record that we talked off the air yesterday, and one of the things we both confessed to each other. I'm 65 years old, and you can say whatever age you want.
Yeah, well, I'm a little bit older, but I don't want to say my age exactly.
But we both confessed that we are having the best sex of our lives.
I know we did.
Now.
Now. Isn't that incredible?
So why the culture continues to think that you have to look like 23 and torture yourself when you're not and mutilate yourself and destroy your face with plastic surgery, stop it. It's okay. We get better anyway. And
we
you
get
don't
better.
Have to pretend, you don't have to be that. You did that, that's done. Now do the next thing.
Right. So we only have about 3 or 4 more minutes.
Right.
We have to stop a little bit before the top of the hour.
I'll
so tell your Sally story, because it's such a great story.
All right. The sub-story is titled 44 Years of Foreplay. 44 Years of Foreplay. The hottest sex I ever had was in the eighth grade. It was with a woman named Sally, and it was petting. It was not any penis in vagina sex. It was all just petting. It was the first time for all of those things, and they were red hot. They were red hot. They were the kind of red hot that you didn't even know such things existed. And as I mentioned earlier, it was the male initiating the sex acts and the female putting on the brakes when things got to be too much. We were petting for an entire summer in her game room with a Kingston Trio on the record player. And one of those times she let me wrap, she let me take my bare penis and put it in her vagina with her panties still on. So I have like the panties like a, working like a condom, and I'm in like about half an inch. And at,
right.
that, and at that place, I have an orgasm, Annie Oakley bullseye. And she jumps up and starts screaming. She's trying to see up her own legs. And it's very funny now. It wasn't then because she was so scared. It scared me. She said, "It's all so wet. I don't know what's you and what's me. I don't want to be pregnant." She was just terrified she was pregnant.
Right.
And of course,
right.
So was I. We're eighth graders.
Of course.
We wait for her period. Her period doesn't come. Now I'm making deals with God. If you let her not be pregnant, I won't jerk off. I promise. I won't touch myself. And since I was touching myself, oh, 2-3 times a day, I thought it was a hell of an offer. But God wasn't answering my call. So, I don't know, 10 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, finally her period starts again. And we go right back to what we were doing again.
Yeah.
Except I never got that close ever again with an orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
And then as magically as it all started, it just disappeared because we were scared.
Mm-hmm.
We were scared we could no longer stop ourselves in the pre-penetration stages. And again, we had to get through the ninth grade first before we consider having sex meant marrying then, and we were a little too young to get married.
Yeah.
We had to do algebra first. So we stopped seeing each other. And if I'd have known that I was going to have more sex in the eighth grade than I was going to have for the rest of high school, I would have never let that happen, but it happened. Okay, so I have pictures ever since those nights in the eighth grade of the scenes from my petting in my head. When I masturbate, when I get aroused, those pictures come back. They're like moments frozen in amber.
And I red keep, hot fantasies.
I keep returning them over and over.
Uh-huh.
At the 10th high school reunion, which was before I got involved in the X-rated business, I saw her, and I let her know how pleasant my memories were. And there was no mistaking my extending an invitation to let's go finish this right now. And she just stiffened and said to me, "My husband takes care of all my sexual needs." And I thought, oh, fuck. Well, my wife takes care of mine, too, but so what? We have red-hot sex that doesn't exist anywhere else on Earth between each other to have. She wasn't there. She didn't get it.
Okay, wrap this up, Howie, because we got to get off the air.
All right. So there's a lot more drama I could build here. But 44 years later, she said yes. 44 years later, she said yes. And you want to read
that
again?
That was closure for you, finally.
Would you read the end again, what you wrote, what I wrote, what you said?
Life gave us a pass. We were 14 years old again, only this time we were not afraid of sexual pleasure. We had the benefit of knowledge and appreciation. There was no fear, and there was no shame. There was consummation. There was completion. And then you say, what a gift
she gave me.
She had given me.
Yeah.
That's beautiful, Howie.
Amen.
Yep. Well, you're a wonderful man. And when I'm in the Bay Area, because that's where you live, the San Francisco Bay Area, Brian and I are going to visit you and your wife in January. So I'm really looking forward to that because I feel like I know you pretty well already just from these radio interviews.
Yeah. Well, we're getting pretty intimate here.
We are, and you have been a fabulous guest. I'm going to try to cajole you into doing a part 3 maybe in a month or so. So stay tuned, everybody. Thanks again, Howie.
Mwah.
Oh, mwah, back. All right, this is Dr. Diana Wiley signing off. I'll be back next week.